In the Royal Navy, the destroyer, at least since its first iteration as the torpedo boat destroyer, had been grouped into formations known as flotillas. This is roughly similar to what some other navies would term destroyer squadrons. Most of these numbered in the single digits and would persist for as long as the Royal Navy had enough destroyers to actually justify having more than one flotilla, but higher numbered flotillas tended to come and go as the need arose, particularly in wartime, when ships in reserve would be activated and new ships would be built in numbers and at quite considerable speed. Such was the case with the 10th Destroyer Flotilla. First formed at the end of 1914 for World War I, it was originally a powerful force led by the light cruiser HMS Aurora, and comprising some of the most modern and powerful destroyers in the Royal Navy at the time. Thanks to Royal Navy naming conventions for destroyers being letter-based rather than anything else, this meant that you had ships like the Manly, the Mastiff, the Matchless, the Meteor, and the Termagant, sharing a formation with Morris, Murray, Miranda, and Retriever. The formation, nevertheless, was on the front line for the entirety of World War I, serving as part of the Harwich Force, although four of its ships did contrive to wind up at the Battle of Jutland by means of being on temporary assignment to other flotillas at the time. As a wartime flotilla, though, the formation was disbanded in early 1919. 10th Destroyer Flotilla would then briefly reappear in 1940 and 1941 as something of an ad hoc formation thrown together from the famous Australian Scrap Iron Flotilla and a few other Mediterranean Fleet destroyers. But this too would be disbanded the year after it was reformed, as most of its constituent ships were drawn off to other duties across the world. But a couple of years later, the Royal Navy found itself facing a dilemma. Although by 1943 the tide of war had definitely turned, the Germans still controlled the French side of the Channel and the French Atlantic coasts. Indeed, they by this point moved to take over the entirety of France. This put a bit of a crimp on the plans to blockade Germany. In World War I, it had been a case of containing the North Sea. Now, however, there needed to be active patrols all the way down to the coast of Spain and all the way up to the western approaches as well. Otherwise, various vital war materials, usually in relatively small amounts compared to, you know, things like steel production, of critical resources like tungsten or rubber, which could only be obtained from overseas, could be shipped in via blockade runners to the French Atlantic ports and sustain both the existing German war effort as well as supporting the development of new weapons and technology. Patrols of this nature were indeed being conducted, but the Germans started to time the arrival of their blockade runners for nighttime. Night, of course, being a great leveller, for although the Royal Navy was much better trained for night fighting in World War II than it had been in World War I, a good deal of the leverage they had over the Kriegsmarine still vanished at night. Most aircraft were still daytime only, most night-capable aircraft weren't designed for airborne search, much less pinpoint airborne attack, and even those with air-to-surface radar had a much more limited view of what was going on the surface compared to an aircraft operating in daylight where observers could just look out as far as the eye could see. Submarines on patrol likewise had their ability to detect enemy ship movements much reduced, and so very often it came down to limited and sporadic intelligence reports and clashes between the small patrol units and German forces, which of course could choose when and where to sortie and in what strength. Although both sides had surface search radar to varying degrees of effectiveness, this still meant that clashes could be surprising, brief, and quite vicious, with the confusion of the night able to wildly tip the balance of a battle that on paper at least should have been one-sided. Such was the case in late October 1943, when the light cruiser Charybdis and six destroyers, a far more powerful force than the five German Elbing-class torpedo boats which came out to meet them, was badly defeated with the loss of the cruiser and one of the destroyers, with the Germans getting their blockade runner through unscathed. The disaster also brought into stark relief another issue. If the planned invasion of France in 1944 was going to go ahead, they couldn't really afford to have powerful German coastal formations coming out and getting in among the invasion transports. So something more than the current measures would have to be done. Deciding what exactly that response should be was Vice Admiral Leatham. Although his previous war experience meant that he'd been advocating for a specialist strike force to be formed to cleanse the seas of the Kriegsmarine for some time, he'd been denied by the higher-ups. Now, however, he was able to make the loss of lives aboard the Charybdis mean something by pointing out that the formation in question was indeed powerful on paper, but in reality fatally flawed. Four of its destroyers had been Hunt-class escort destroyers, one of which had been lost. Two of the destroyers were full-sized, even if wartime emergency type, fleet destroyers, and of course the Charybdis had been a Dido-class anti-aircraft cruiser. These were ships of very different capabilities who hadn't actually been at sea together before, and although of course they all had night fighting training, they had lacked much in the way of actual practical experience in the field. Leatham argued that this new formation that he was proposing should be made up of ships that were individually powerful, experienced, and at least of broadly similar capabilities in terms of things like speed. And they should be manned by the kind of officers whose first recourse in the face of the enemy would be to attack, whose plan B was also to attack, whose plan C was to attack even harder, and whose plan D was to ram board and take the enemy by the edge of the sword. Essentially, he was asking for a bunch of men who were either insanely aggressive or potentially aggressively insane to be given command of what would, broadly speaking, become a heavily armed floating asylum full of like-minded sailors and then pointed in the general direction of the enemy before being let loose while everybody else took cover to watch the ensuing carnage. Naturally, this created a shortlist of three potential candidates from which to draw the ships. Firstly, the tribal-class destroyers. These were the Royal Navy's preferred containment facilities for men who had yet to meet a ship at sea that they didn't dearly want to explode. Second, the it's-not-illegal-when-you-do-it-the-first-time Canadians, who, pleasingly and perhaps unsurprisingly, had tribal-class destroyers of their own. And third, the we-sailed-across-two-entire-seas to keep on fighting for vengeance and nobody's heard a bell just yet, Poles, who didn't have any tribal class but made up for it by being willing to fight pretty much anyone with pretty much anything, which also made them extremely popular in certain pubs and bars across the UK. Unfortunately for this plan, of the 16 Royal Navy tribal class destroyers that had started the war, only four of them were still actually afloat, most of the rest having been lost in combat that epitomised exactly the kind of captain Leatham was actually looking for. Gurkha had been sunk trying to countercharge an air attack, Bedouin had fought a pair of Italian light cruisers and then shot down the torpedo bomber that had dropped the torpedo that finally finished her off, Seek had fought most of Tobruk's coastal batteries one-handed while escorting a commando raid, and Somali had needed the Arctic Ocean's weather to finish her off after she'd eaten a torpedo from U-703 while she was on convoy escort up there in the frozen wastes. By late 1943, only Ashanti, Eskimo, Nubian and Tartar were still afloat. And different parts of Eskimo were in fact of different ages, since she appeared to consider her bow to be something of an expendable item. While a powerful force, if brought together, four ships still did not a flotilla make, and in late 1943, Tartar was in refit, Eskimo was under repair again, Ashanti was in the Arctic, and Nubian was over in the Mediterranean. However, with Italy bowing out of the war and the destruction of the Scharnhorst at the end of the year, demands for the remaining tribals had eased up somewhat, and most of them would soon be capable of reassignment. To build up the numbers to a true flotilla, the team would thus ultimately be formed from Tartar, Eskimo and Ashanti from the Royal Navy, their sister ships Haida and Huron from the Royal Canadian Navy, and the J-class HMS Javelin, which was still a powerful ship and had a long history of combat efficiency, plus the Polish Pieron, famous for taunting the battleship Bismarck via searchlight, the other famous Polish destroyer Blyskowice, which has endured in British memory for single-handedly disrupting a heavy German bomber raid on the city of Cowes on the Isle of Wight, and other tribal-class destroyers, the Nubian, the Athabascan and Iroquois, would also frequently be part of 10th Destroyer Flotilla, with supporting elements coming in the form of either the Abdiel-class HMS Apollo, the Bellona-class HMS Bellona, or most often, the Bellona-class HMS Black Prince. Although radar was considered vital to a successful night engagement, as was quite common across the Allied fleets during the war, not all ships had the same radar suite, even if they were ships from the same class. For example, if we just look at the tribals alone, Most of those in 10th Destroyer Flotilla would have the Type 285P radar for gunnery control. This was a modification of the Type 285 anti-aircraft gunnery radar that had proved to be remarkably capable in the direction of destroyer caliber guns in a surface action as well. It was actually sensitive enough to track the ship's shells during flight, as well as tracking the target, and it was found, somewhat disconcertingly, in action, that it could also see incoming enemy shells as well. For more general air and surface search, most ships had the Type 291 radar, but other radars that were installed varied somewhat. Athabascan, Tartar and Ashanti also had Type 276 surface search radar, while Hyder and Huron had older Type 271Q installations. Javelin and the two polar ships also had fairly modern radar suites, but again, their upgrades arrived at different times, and so exactly which radar they had at any given point did vary. As the flotilla began to assemble, other equipment was fitted to all ships as standard. Reduced flash charges were equipped to the guns, which both served to hide the ships when they were firing, and also to help maintain night vision for the ship's gunners and crew. Tracer fittings were fitted to the shells so that they could be tracked on their arcs through the sky. The GEE, or G, radio navigation set, adopted from the RAF, was also installed. This allowed ships to work out where they were to within a few ships' lengths by means of overlapping radio signal beams, as long as they were in range of said stations, as well as a piece of electronic warfare equipment called Headache, which theoretically allowed the men aboard 10th Destroyer Flotilla to listen in on enemy radio transmissions. There was also a basic IFF, or Identify Friend or Foe system, installed to hopefully prevent friendly fire in the heat of battle. Although most of the ships were technically ready by the end of January 1944, some were still on other duties, and Admiral Leatham insisted that, of the ones he had already gathered, they should spend most of the next 2 months in a series of intensive training exercises to ensure they all knew how to operate together. In between these exercises, there were periodic sweeps of nearby sections of the French coast, but no German ships were found during these early operations. As April rolled around, though, Leatham pronounced the training of this first batch of destroyers complete, and then pointed them full-time at the French coast with instructions that essentially boiled down to enemy bad. Enemy over there. Go over there, blow up enemy, everyone happy. First contact would be made on the night of the 25th through 26th of April. Ashanti, Hyder, Athabascan and Huron were sailing along with Black Prince when they detected a formation of Elbing-class torpedo boats, which were really small destroyers, but in any case they were out on a mine-laying expedition. And so 10th Destroyer Flotilla moved to engage. Black Prince stood off at a distance, lobbing star shells, while the four destroyers split into hunting pairs, one firing additional star shells at whichever target the pair had chosen for pain that evening, and the other firing exclusively live rounds at the ship that was so highlighted. The Germans tried to evade by running at high speed through rocks and shallow water along the French coast. That didn't help Admiral Conflans at the Battle of Quiberon Bay, and it didn't help them now, because the 10th simply followed them, using a combination of following in their enemy's wake, along with their own radar, to keep them safe from rocks and shoals in the darkness. All of the German ships were hit. One of them had most of her power plant crippled and dove off into a nearby bay to hide among the radar echoes of the coastline, but the T-29 took a hit to her rudder, which forced her off course. Ashanti and Huron ran her down and riddled her with shellfire, and once it was clear she was sinking, they moved in to pick up survivors. Joined shortly thereafter by Hyder and Athabascan, who'd been unable to finish off their own target after setting it on fire a couple of times before it got too close to the French coast. However, some absolute moron on the sinking T-29 opened up on the closing destroyers with a 20mm flak cannon, of all things, resulting in an entirely unsurprising resumption of heavy fire that sent T-29 to the bottom rather rapidly, taking 137 men with her, about two-thirds of the crew. And then the 10th left, just in case there was still more resistance forthcoming. After all, one of the tribal class had been lost a couple of years earlier in the Mediterranean when a sinking Italian destroyer had taken a pot shot with its remaining torpedo launcher. The sum total result of the 20mm gunner's efforts was that only 73 survivors of T-29 were actually left, and they had to wait for a friendly patrol boat to pick them up sometime later. 3 nights later, though, Hyder and Athabascan were out covering a British mine-laying operation when they ran into the survivors of the previous battle, who had patched themselves up and were trying to make it to a larger port for repairs. Upon realising who their opponents were, the German ships dumped torpedoes at them and turned to run away. The tribals responded by turning toward the torpedoes to present the smallest possible target, but unfortunately one of the torpedoes still had a straight run in at Athabascan, hitting her and leaving her dead in the water. Hyder stood by to take on survivors, but Athabascan exploded about a quarter of an hour later. Exactly why is still debated. Some sources claim she was hit by another German torpedo, some claim accidental friendly fire from an Allied motor torpedo boat, while others point to fires started by the first hit, just eventually reaching the magazines. Whatever the case, Hyder had gotten some revenge before she headed back to help out her sister by hitting T-27 hard enough to force her to be run aground, where she'd be later fully destroyed by airstrikes. But with dawn approaching rapidly, Hyder was forced to leave the French coast. This meant that she accidentally left her motor cutter behind, along with its 5-man crew. Undeterred, the small boat rescued 6 more men from Athabascan, then came across 2 of their own shipmates who'd actually been on the nets that Hyder had let down her side and had been helping others out of the water, and they'd been swept away as the ship gathered speed. With this collection of soaked sailors on board, the motor cutter headed out for open sea with a variety of German ships in hot pursuit. After some rather epic adventures heading across the channel throughout the day under pursuit and occasionally attack, the cutter showed up on the friendly side of the channel just before midnight, having spent no less than 19 hours making their intrepid way home. The 10th now began to plan new tactics. In both of their engagements, the German approach seemed to be dump torpedoes at the enemy and run away. They needed to find a way to avoid the torpedoes while still being able to close with the enemy quickly enough to get into close range and finish them off. It fell to Commander Jones, the captain of the Tartar, to devise the appropriate measures. Previously, night actions were fought with all ships in a line-ahead formation. This allowed everyone to keep in contact, avoiding friendly fire, but in chases it meant that almost all the ships were masked by one or more ships ahead of them, both for gunfire and for radar. Instead, he proposed sailing in line ahead generally at night, as it did make station keeping easier, but immediately upon report or contact with the enemy, whichever came first, the formation should instead move to line abreast. This would allow each ship to use its own radar freely and unleash the full forward firepower of 10th destroyer flotilla's ships, which was actually greater than the full broadside firepower of many interwar destroyers, as even Piron and Javelin, which only had 3 twin mounts instead of 4, had 2 of them forward and just the 1 aft. Thus, every ship in the flotilla had a forward firepower of 4 guns, even assuming none of their aft armament could be brought to bear. By this point, all the ships that would make the 10th famous had joined up. Some of them had taken a little bit of time to be extricated from their previous assignments. But these reinforcements couldn't come soon enough, for although the 10th's efforts had reduced the German 4th torpedo boat flotilla to a sole survivor, the T-24, the Normandy landings on the 6th of June had triggered the Germans to move their own 8th destroyer flotilla, which was made up of the big Narvik or Type 1936A destroyers Z-24 and Z-32, along with the smaller ex-Dutch ZH-1, from southwestern France up to the port of Brest, where they'd joined up with the T-24, and they'd all made ready to sail to Cherbourg, from which they'd be in easy striking distance of the Allied landing positions. The German ships all had experienced commanders aboard, but otherwise the formation suffered from a number of weaknesses. A lack of fuel had limited their training time at sea. Losses among the U-boat arm had drawn away a number of experienced crews as replacements. And, like the British formations of 1943, the Narviks, ZH-1 and T-24 were all of widely differing speeds and capabilities. Allied intelligence monitored their progress along the French coast, and when they finally headed for Cherbourg, 10th destroyer flotilla was ordered to intercept. With a full suite of ships at his disposal, Leatham had grouped the most experienced tribals, Tartar, Ashanti, Huron and Hyder, into the 19th Division. The newer arrivals, Eskimo, Javelin, Piron, and Bliskavica, were in the 20th Division. Commander Jones aboard Tartar would be the flag officer for operations while the formation was at sea. At 0114 on the morning of the 9th of June, 1944, Tartar's radar detected the German formation 10 miles out, and the two divisions turned to close in on their targets. German radar aboard destroyers by this point in the war had fallen behind Allied radar somewhat, and while the 10th was closing in with a solid lock on the Germans, the Germans' own radar only began to return sporadic and vague contacts sometime later. It wasn't actually until moonlight flashed off the side of the charging tribals that they knew for sure that the enemy was out there. The three German full-size destroyers quickly turned about and loosed half their torpedoes each, or roughly thereabouts, but this time the tactic was ineffective. That headache electronic warfare system meant the 10th knew about the order to launch the torpedoes before the torpedo crews on some of the German ships did. Between this early warning and each ship now being in line abreast, allowing for much more flexibility in manoeuvring, the torpedoes were easily dodged. At this point, the Germans only knew about the 19th Division, thus thinking it was a 4v4 engagement. The 20th Division was about 2 miles further north and racing in unspotted. This paid some dividends, as the German ships had wheeled to port and were thus heading northward through the arc of their turn, after exchanging some gunfire with Tartar, an exchange that had resulted in hits on both sides. Z-32, at the lead of the formation, put the pedal to the metal and zoomed off to presumed safety, only to run straight into the waiting guns of the 20th Division, which pummeled Z-32. But at that moment, Z-32 loosed more torpedoes in a desperate ploy. But it was a desperate ploy that worked. Bliskavica intercepted the order to launch torpedoes and turned to evade them, laying a smokescreen as well. But this resulted in confusion, and in the confusion, the 20th Division ended up heading in the wrong direction and accidentally took themselves out of the battle. Z-32 was less lucky. Also turning away, in something of a panic, she ran straight back into Tartar, resulting in another exchange of fire that peppered Tartar's bridge with 5.9-inch shells and temporarily knocked out her radio gear. Although the formation flagship, 10th Destroyers Flotilla's captains had been selected for aggression, and so, in the absence of any other orders, Ashanti, Haida, and Huron simply piled on the power and went after anything that was ahead of them. Despite being mildly on fire, Tartar also pressed on, flame streaming from her bridge like a light-up banner. Z-32 had yet another bit of both good and bad luck. Ashanti spotted her and opened fire, only for smoke from Tartar's burning bridge to cover Z-32 and allow her to escape. Ashanti then started looking for where Z-32 had gone, using her radar, but instead stumbled across the much-abused ZH-1, which had been subject to a withering hail of fire from Ashanti and Tartar earlier on, while Z-32 was off bothering 20th Division. With her machinery spaces hit repeatedly, ZH-1 had vanished into a pool of steam and smoke, from which she was only just now beginning to crawl, only to find that Tartar and Ashanti were now practically on top of her as they barreled along looking for Z-32. Even while men fought fires and treated casualties on the bridge, Tartar opened up on ZH-1 with her guns, while Ashanti sent a couple of torpedoes downrange for good measure. Shattered and sinking, ZH-1's crews abandoned ship, with a few men remaining behind to find the scuttling charges and place them. They did perhaps too good a job, because shortly thereafter, ZH-1 vanished in an apocalyptic explosion that startled people out of bed on both sides of the channel. Further south, Haida and Huron were merrily chasing down Z-24 and T-24. The Z-24 took multiple hits and evaded towards the north, only to receive further hits from Tartar and Ashanti. Then she piled on the speed and ran southwest. T-24 dodged around the burning remains of ZH-1 as the Canadian ships pursued her, with Haida's famous Captain de Wolf writing in his report that the smaller torpedo boat hadn't been immediately destroyed, as both it and Z-24 were, to quote, engaged with the wind dead ahead and rain squalls frequent. Cloud base was never more than 1,000 feet and often as low as 500 feet. Consequently, illumination was poor and star shell were generally half burned before they affected any illumination whatsoever. The enemy made excellent use of smoke throughout and continuously took avoiding action, thus making spotting at times well nigh impossible. End quote. Still, T-24 was being overhauled when the navigation officers aboard the Canadian ships pointed out that she and Z-24 were now entering a British minefield, which had been laid some time earlier to block U-boats. Haida and Huron thus had to divert around the minefield, losing ground, while the Germans unknowingly ploughed straight through it, miraculously not setting off any of the mines. With the distance opened up to be too great to close down again in reasonable time, De Wolf ordered the pursuit called off, and the two damaged German ships would eventually make it back to Brest, which was where they'd started. Tartar had restored its radio systems by this point, and Commander Jones was trying to work out where everybody was. All four tribals from his division were now converging, and Haida and Huron detected something about 6 miles away on bearing 032. Given that their last information indicated Tartar should be on bearing 040, along with her companion, they were suspicious. But they held fire since Tartar was known to be damaged, and its IFF might be offline. Instead, they signalled the contact by light. But although they received a reply, it wasn't anything they recognised. Still, they feared that it might still be Tartar, since a hit to the bridge might well have damaged her signal lights and wounded her regular signal crew. And so there might be some random crewman desperately trying to signal who she was and failing. Still, they trained their guns out, but held fire. In fact, they had discovered Z-32, which was in fact signalling the German recognition signal on her signal lamps and training out its own guns. But the lack of fire from the two incoming vessels persuaded Z-32 that they might well be Z-24 and T-24. And so both sides passed each other, the Canadian ships heading northeast, and Z-32 heading northwest. However, Z-32 gradually looped back around towards the east, trying to reach Saint-Malo, since it was now only a few hours until dawn, and reaching Cherbourg before then was pretty much out of the question. This made De Wolf suspicious, and he began to follow, and then fired a star shell. This backlit a distinctly non-tribal outline, and so Haida and Huron immediately opened fire and began to land hits. Z-32 ducked away, going through the same minefield that Z-24 and T-24 had passed through, only now heading in the opposite direction. De Wolf must have been tempted to howl in frustration as the same ineffective minefield once again forced him to break contact and sail around it, while once again a German ship sailed through completely unharmed. Aboard Z-32, the mood was actually quite upbeat. Although damaged, Captain von Bechtolsheim believed that Z-24 and T-24 were somewhere ahead of him to the east, and together he reckoned they could probably force their way past a pair of enemy destroyers. But at 0420 he received signals from those two ships, which were of course some distance to the west and heading even further that way at speed, and they were asking official permission to head back to Brest. Realising that he was quite alone, Z-32 was ordered to turn back and catch up with Z-24 and T-24. However, Haida and Huron had gone around the minefield at full speed and were now coming in hard from the northwest, and when De Wolf saw the range to target turn from dropping slowly, as they overhauled it, to dropping rapidly, it soon became apparent that Z-32 had turned around and was heading west again, and De Wolf was absolutely not going to allow the blasted minefield to thwart him for a third time. The two Canadian ships headed straight south to cut off Z-32's line of advance, while Commander Jones aboard Tartar marshalled the rest of the 10th in a skirmish line to the north. Z-32 was now well and truly boxed in. At 0444, Haida and Huron opened fire again. The brief flashes of the reduced charge cordite only briefly highlighted them as their broadsides thundered out. Seeing a flickering pair of shapes with four twin sets of guns pointed his way, Z-32 concluded that these must be either Bellona or Leander-class cruisers and turned south while returning fire. Water splashed up all around the ship, and hits began to register. The two Canadian tribals surged forward in pursuit, and soon the portside engine on the German ship was out of action. Then the forward guns were hit, and then everything was on fire. Z-32 held out just a little longer, hoping that the enemy would run out of shells, such was the weight of fire directed at her, but when yet another salvo knocked out the other engine, Z-32 was turned to starboard and deliberately run aground. The engagement was dubbed yet another instalment in the long history of Battles of Ushant. This would be the biggest action that 10th Destroyer Flotilla would be involved in, but it was far from the last. On the night of the 13th and 14th of June, Ashanti and Piron were sent to cover motor torpedo boats, which were in turn tasked with rendering Z-32's beached hulk irreparable. But as they stood by, a small German convoy, escorted by a large collection of M-class minesweepers, appeared. The convoy quickly began to scatter, and the destroyers laid into whatever was nearby, officially credited with sinking two of the escorts and damaging another two, although some reports indicated that at least three or four others were also damaged to one degree or another. On the 24th of June, Eskimo and Haider were on a sweep to secure passage for supply ships, supporting the famous 2nd Escort Group under the command of Captain Johnny Walker, who was sweeping for submarines while the 10th was providing cover against potential surface interference. Nearby, though, was the embattled U-971, a Type 7C submarine that had been sent out through the North Sea and around the Scottish coast into the Atlantic, but then been recalled back to the Channel in the aftermath of the D-Day invasion. Having completed a complete anti-clockwise circuit of the UK by sea, the submarine had been repeatedly attacked by aircraft, and at this stage, quite a lot of things aboard were broken, including several of its torpedo tubes and the toilet. About mid-afternoon, the two destroyers spotted a Liberator about 5 miles behind them, merrily dropping depth charges on something. The pilot was one Jan Vela of 311 Squadron. This was a Czech unit, and so Haider's attempts to ask what exactly was going on ran into something of a language barrier. But they did intercept the standard message that the Liberator was transmitting back to the Admiralty. The Liberator was attacking a U-boat that it had spotted at periscope depth. In keeping with the ideals of the 10th, Haider and Eskimo promptly raced off toward the explosions at top speed. Once in the area, they slowed down and began to ping away with their ASDIC, and soon both ships had a firm lock. Rather chivalrously, they radioed Captain Walker and asked, "Do you want to come and take over?" Equally chivalrously, Captain Walker signalled, "Nah, go ahead and claim the kill." However, the contact didn't seem to be moving, and Captain DeWolf concluded it might be a false contact, the real sub having presumably escaped. But as he made to withdraw, the ASDIC team appeared on the bridge and insisted that this was a solid contact and they wanted to attack it. DeWolf decided, well, the ASDIC team probably knew best, and so Haider and Eskimo spent a merry afternoon lobbing depth charges into the channel. But after 2 hours, nothing much seemed to have changed, and so DeWolf ordered one more pattern of depth charges for luck before heading back on station. In fact, U-971 had gone to ground, quite literally, taking advantage of the fact the channel in this area was shallower than the submarine's test depth to simply lay on the seabed and hope everything went away. By sheer luck, the last barrage, launched for luck, landed almost on top of the sub, all of the others having been close and damaging all sorts of equipment, but not posing a peril of life for the U-boat. But this last barrage opened up the propeller shaft glands and one of the diving tanks. Water began to rise inside the sub, and above them, Haider and Eskimo were still there, listening very carefully before moving off in case their quarry showed signs of life and tried to hunt them. Inside U-971, the rising waters gradually shorted and overwhelmed the batteries one by one, and from somewhere in the sub was coming the very unwelcome sound of the hiss of escaping pressurized air. By 1900, water was knee-deep in the control room, and the submarine's captain realised there were really only two courses of action left. One, hope what was left of their air supply was enough to make a dash for the surface by blowing the ballast tanks, or they could wait another 10 minutes, at which point the sub would be stuck on the channel bottom forever as it became too heavy to move. It really was no choice at all, and so with the crew working on destroying the Enigma machine and any other coded or sensitive papers, the ballast tanks were blown, and the submarine shuddered. For a horrible moment, it seemed that the order might have come too late, but then it came free of the seabed and began to rise faster and faster. Shortly thereafter, the submarine breached the surface, as one of Haider's crew recalled. The submarine was almost between us and the Eskimo, and she, Eskimo, went full astern to back up when the buoys opened up with the 20mm. B-gun was fully manned at this time, and when the submarine surfaced, they depressed the gun to fire at the submarine. We were cruising with the guns elevated at 45 degrees, anti-submarine positions, A gun off to starboard and B gun to port. The sub was so close, about 200 yards, that they had to depress A gun so B wouldn't hit the barrels. That gave Eskimo time to back up before we opened fire. The first salvo hit the sub, and the second one too. That's all B-gun fired. Two salvos for four hits. Soon fire was checked when it became clear the sub was in no shape to offer resistance, and instead boats were lowered to pick up survivors and, if possible, capture the sub. But the progressive leaks and Haider's gunfire had done too good a job, and the sub soon slipped back under the waves for the last time. However, unusually for a U-boat that was lost in action, all but one of her crew survived, although some were injured, and they were taken aboard the two destroyers. On the 9th of the 27th through 28th of June, Eskimo and Huron came across a number of minesweepers and trawlers, this time sinking at least two of them and damaging several more. Although they had to close in to almost point-blank range as the German ships had laid a smoke barrier to try and escape. Part of the battle report describes the action in which Eskimo took damage. At about 01:25, Eskimo passed through the line of smoke. The enemy was well hit during the approach, but she was not seen to burn, though smoke was caused by the hits. On clearing the smoke, a trawler, Target C, appeared close to Eskimo's port side, bearing 310 degrees. She had been detected earlier but not tracked continuously, and was reported at this time to be on a similar bearing to Target B, but 2,000 yards further on. She opened a rapid and accurate fire on Eskimo using one 3-inch gun, one gun approximately similar to a Bofors, and about four 20mm. She obtained hits with the 20mm on the ship's side and aft superstructure almost at once, and before her fire could be returned, the 3-inch fire was all over. An auxiliary saturated steam pipe in the drenching system was severed in number one boiler room, with steam causing it to be evacuated. Two shells were discovered subsequently in the boiler, which had pierced 6-inch tubes. Steam pressure dropped to less than 100 pounds, and the ship's speed reduced to about 6 knots or less. A large quantity of steam and smoke escaped, reducing visibility astern to almost nil. One dynamo came off the board, the steering motor stopped, and a number of lighting circuits failed, and power to the foremost guns also failed. The foremost guns continued to engage the starboard target, and hits were obtained, the range being less than 1,000 yards. The port target, who continued an unpleasantly rapid and accurate fire, was engaged by close-range weapons, and the aft group of guns shifted fire to her, firing under local control. Close-range weapons obtained a number of hits, but the fire from the aft group was not very effective, owing largely to the smoke and steam still then enveloping the ship. Eskimo was reluctant to open blind fire in that direction with the heavy guns, as Huron was known to be on that bearing, and the radar staff were constantly reminding everybody of her presence. A few hits were obtained, but they didn't succeed in stopping the trawler, which was now opening the range to eastward as rapidly as she could. Unfortunately, during this period, when its fire should have been devastating, all power to the pom-pom had failed. The automatic electrical power changeover switch, which operated when the dynamo came off the board, succeeded in shorting the switch, thereby causing a failure of supply from the aft power source. This mounting in hand control is extremely cumbersome and cannot be expected to be controlled effectively at night. The port number one twin Orlikans also jammed. In effect, we were almost outgunned by this determined and gallant trawler. The damage to the boiler rooms was reported by wireless to the Commander-in-Chief of Plymouth. Eskimo was then taken in for quick repairs. On the 9th of the 30th of June through 1st of July, Ashanti and Piron successfully engaged a number of trawlers off the Channel Islands, sinking two or three of them. On the 1st and 2nd of July, Tartar, Huron and Eskimo, with their boiler patched up, as well as Javelin, patrolled off Ushant, but Eskimo and Javelin then collided and had to be taken back to Plymouth for repairs once again. On the 8th, Tartar and Huron engaged and sank two minesweepers from the German 46th Flotilla, which along with other minesweepers and E-boats had been escorting a small convoy. As German activity in the Western Channel decreased, the 10th extended its reach into the Bay of Biscay to try and intercept the German evacuation from the ports in the area. And on the 14th and 15th of July, Tartar, Haider and Bliskovica destroyed an enemy convoy off Lorient, sinking or damaging most of the ships present. On the 5th through 6th of August, Tartar, Iroquois, Ashanti, Haider and the cruiser Bellona destroyed two convoys off Saint-Nazaire. The minesweepers M263 and M486, the patrol boat V414, and a coastal launch, together with four small merchant ships which they'd been escorting, were all sunk. On the 12th of August, Piron took part in sinking the German mine clearance ship Speerbrecher 7 near La Rochelle, in company with the cruiser Diadem and the destroyer Onslow. On the 14th and 15th of August, Iroquois, The destroyer Ursa and the cruiser Mauritius attacked two other convoys. The German minesweeper M385 was hit and became a near total loss after being beached, along with a number of merchant ships that were hit and sunk. Another Speerbrecher, this time the 157, along with the torpedo boat T-24, the minesweeper M275, and a coaster, were also damaged. On the 20th through 23rd of August, the Iroquois, Ursa, and Mauritius were once again on patrol and successfully attacked two convoys in the Bay of Biscay, sinking patrol boats V-702, V-717, V-720, V-729, and V-730. There were, of course, also many patrols that took place in between these actions where no contact with the enemy was successfully achieved. This was the end of the flotilla's naval actions as a whole, as by this stage the lack of major organised German opposition was leading to some ships being reassigned, others taken in for repairs, and still others being farmed out in ones and twos to act as veteran corps for other formations, as you might have noticed with those last two successful engagements, especially during the operations taking place in the Bay of Biscay. By September, the 10th Destroyer Flotilla was formally withdrawn from combat operations as the majority of its still assigned ships were now being nominated for refit and dispatched to the Pacific, where it was thought they'd be an excellent source of pain for the Imperial Japanese Navy. Indeed, Tartar, Eskimo, and Nubian would all make it out there, with most of the rest of the ships that had been in the 10th assigned to the home fleet during 1945. But 10th Destroyer Flotilla had been formed for a very specific purpose, and so in spring 1945 the flotilla was disbanded, with its remaining ships transferred to 2nd Destroyer Flotilla and other formations, thus closing a brief one-year window in which the ships of the formation were credited with the sinking of at least 35 enemy surface ships and one submarine, plus another 14 damaged, that's surface ships. Potentially, there's more to be added to that kill sheet, depending on which sources you believe. All of this in exchange for the loss of the Athabascan, which wasn't a bad score, if you ask me.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.